This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. Today, we are speaking to Sonia Gale, a trustee for Breast Cancer Now with personal experience of a breast cancer diagnosis in the workplace. Sonia worked in financial services for more than 30 years at HSBC, Barclays and Ernst & Young. She's a commissioner for the Sheffield Race Equality Commission, and she's also involved with Women on Boards UK as a mentor and presenter supporting diverse talent on boards. And she's here to tell us about when she was diagnosed with breast cancer and how companies can better support an employee with cancer. Sonia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Could you start by telling us when and how you were diagnosed with breast cancer, please?
Oh, my goodness. So we're probably going back to 2004, which was when I was officially diagnosed. But obviously, hindsight is a wonderful thing. And I recognized during my treatment that I'd had the cancer for probably several years, but didn't realize. I was in Sweden, actually, with a friend who was filming, and I tagged along. We were in Stockholm, and we hadn't gone very far from the hotel when I suddenly realized my legs were no longer working. A very weird sensation standing there and thinking, can I take another step without falling over? I've never had a sensation like it. And I remember standing there, feeling a bit, and my friend looking at me saying, what are you doing? And I said, I felt rather embarrassed. I said, I can't feel my legs. She said, don't be silly. I said, no, seriously, I cannot feel my legs. And the concierge came, helped me back to the hotel, and they took me to the hospital, took some bloods, and didn't say anything. They said it may have been cramp, a trapped nerve. And the doctor said, when you get back to the UK, you need to see your GP. And oddly enough, I had been trying to see the GP, but my job was so demanding. It was finding time. You know, I was working 60, 70 hours a week. Financial services is very demanding. I was a senior director. And you put it down to overwork. I need to slow down. But every now and again, I would get bouts of extreme tiredness. You just punch through it. And in fact, I had managed to see the doctor about a year before, who just prescribed iron tablets, which I took diligently. But on that day, they were of no use to me. And when I did return, I managed to see my GP, who was a wonderful lady, Dr. Jean Park, who's now retired. And I can honestly say she saved my life. She listened. I didn't know I had breast cancer. I wasn't sure what was wrong. I just felt odd. I didn't have my usual energy levels. I felt tired at the most odd times. And she noticed me scratching my breast and said, oh, what's that? And because I sometimes used to get eczema, I just said, oh, it's just a little rash. And I'd never known anybody in the family who'd had breast cancer, so had no prior experience or knowledge. And she said, oh, let me have a look. And she said, I'd like you to see someone. So I saw her on the Wednesday. I then had a letter, which was hand-delivered, which arrived on the Saturday for an appointment at Lewisham Hospital in London on the Monday. When I arrived, I didn't realise. I thought, why am I in the breast clinic? I normally go and see a dermatologist. So even then, I had no idea. It was cancer was the last thing on my mind. And I popped in and saw him. And I was chatting away and showing him my breast. And there was an African nurse who was there in the room. And she was smiling, not saying anything. And obviously now I realized she's thinking, oh, wait for it. The penny will drop. She's clearly an intelligent woman. Just give it time. And he was talking away and he said, I don't like the look of this. I'm going to do a needle biopsy and then we'll get you booked in. And I said, what, for a skin rash? And he stared at me and he said, Miss Gale, he said, I really do believe that this is breast cancer. And I said to him, don't be silly. I said, no one in my family gets breast cancer. I said, then black women don't get breast. I actually said that. Anyway, Wednesday, within 48 hours, I was at Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital, running around getting various scans. And it was stage, it was quite advanced. It was in my lymph nodes. They could see hot spots on the back of my lung and at various other places. And they said, there's no time to waste. We need to operate. So you can imagine, this is less than a week. And it was all a whirlwind. And I remember speaking to my partner thinking, I wonder if they've made a mistake. I said, how can I have cancer? You know, I'm walking around. I haven't lost any weight. And I felt okay, other than this tiredness. And they did operate, and it was cancer. And then, of course, it's not just removing the lump, but that's when your treatment really starts.
So what treatment did you have?
So they did a local wide excision. So they were able to preserve all my bits. They were just a little bit smaller, which aesthetically was quite nice. So there's all, you know, so there was a bonus. And then I had to take tamoxifen. And of course, because my background was policy, I did a lot of research. I sat down with the oncologist. We talked through the different treatment options. And they offered me the new, what they said was an innovative form of chemotherapy, but I decided to go with a tried and tested chemo. Even today, the smell of it makes me feel slightly odd. So I tried to avoid going back to Guy's anywhere near where they're doing the treatment, because the smell is very triggering. But it did save my life. I lost all my hair. But my hairdresser, we had a shaving session. So, you know, it was all about getting prepared. And my partner, he shaved his head as well. Not that he had much to begin with, but but we had a head shaving session with a little sip of champagne and just tried to stay positive. And oddly enough, I think, although it was a shock, I realized when I was in the hospital that actually I was one of the lucky ones. One, that they'd found it, that my GP had taken the time to listen and just look at my body holistically. No one goes into the doctor and says, doctor, I think I have cancer. I mean, maybe they do today, but back then I didn't know what was wrong. And she was skilled at listening, looking at all the hidden cues. You say one thing, but your body says something else. And because she acted so promptly, she picked up the phone. She didn't draft a letter. She knew the doctor at Lewisham said, I really need you to see my lady. And remember, this was on the NHS. So, you know, I will always be a fan and an advocate for the NHS, because on that occasion, although I'd never had cause to use it, when I needed it the most, it came to my rescue. I think also I benefited from my postcode, because where I lived, we came within the Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital catchment area, and that's one of the best oncology centres in Europe. So I had fantastic care. But I think also because I was able to read technical data, I understood my treatment and I could make an informed decision. So I wasn't passive.
Yeah.
I did ask them, and I think once they realize that you've done your homework, there is a different relationship between yourself and your oncologist. You can actually, I'm not an equal and I'm not a specialist, but I think he was impressed that I took the time to read about the different forms of treatment. So I was happy to take my pink bullet, tamoxifen, which I took diligently for just over 5 years. And I also had to have Solidex in injections, which was my suggestion, because I had estrogen receptor positive. So I said, well, that's good, but it's not the other one, because if it's my hormones raging out of control, then that's what's feeding the cancer. So let's shut them down. So I had to have tummy injections, which were quite uncomfortable with the Zoladex, but it did shut down my ovaries. And then, of course, there's the other stuff like hot flushers. Mm-hmm. And actually, the wonderful thing that I find in 2023 now is people are taking the menopause very seriously.
It's not just women. Even.
I'm 24. Yes. And because back then it was something you just had to put up with. But of course, when you're having chemical treatments and breast cancer, they don't tell you about the fact that it throws you into an early menopause. And the hot flushes were just ferocious.
Yeah. Well, there's so many things I want to pick up on from what you've just said, and so much of it that I relate to, including the Zoladex injections and the tamoxifen and the wide local excision and so much more. But you mentioned that you were one of the lucky ones, and we are now 20 years on from that diagnosis. So I just want to ask how you're doing now, health-wise.
I'm healthy. I feel I walk. I mean, I moved. I was born in Yorkshire and I returned. One thing with COVID, and we lost some wonderful people and loved ones, but it did reconnect me to my place of birth. And where I live in Sheffield is one of the greenest cities, and you're right on the doorstep of the Peak District. So I do a lot of walking, and I can still travel to London and do things remotely. So that was one of the things, I think, with COVID, it did make people think about work-life balance.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm from Huddersfield and I grew up 15 minutes from the Peak District as well. So more,
another Yorkshire girl.
More parallels there. Yeah, I'm glad yes. You're in the countryside now. But no sign of breast cancer. And, as far as you're aware, you've put that behind you.
Yes. I mean, it took a few years. I would say it's 20 years now. Mm. If you told me then you and I would be here today, I would never have believed it.
Yeah.
In my head, I kind of reconciled that I might have 10 years if I'm fortunate. Mm. But actually, I was one of that small percentage, 15%, who really responded well to the treatment. I think also maybe changing my lifestyle as well. So drinking less, eating healthily, doing a little bit more exercise, trying to stay positive. And so I get my regular checkups, and they are very robust, and touch wood, it's always been very good, no signs of any return. And you spend probably the first couple of years waiting. You're listening to your body at night, and every little rumble and gurgle and twitch and pain, you think, has it come back? But then there comes a point at which you think, I can't keep waiting. You just have to get on and live your life. And I think it's that acceptance that actually the end, if you want to call it the end, is something that happens to all of us. And the only thing you can try and influence is the manner of how you go, and you make sure that you've done all the things that you want to do and have no regrets, or are you living in fear? Somebody made the thing that actually cancer can give you time to put your affairs in order. It's one of the, I wouldn't say that there's an upside to that, but actually my father died from a heart attack, and it was very sudden. One day was with us, and then the next day he'd gone. And I remember the devastation and how it affected my mother, because they'd been together for such a long time. And she'd noticed something wasn't right, but you know, men are men and, oh, it's nothing. And at least with my cancer, I was able to talk to friends. I was able to reconcile with other friends and family members who I hadn't seen for many years. And you kind of put your affairs in order. And it did enable me to change my mindset, and maybe I'm a better person for it. But it shouldn't have taken cancer to reach that epiphany, but I did reach it, and I'm delighted to still be here.
Well, I'm delighted you're still here as well, and it's so good, especially on this podcast, to hear these positive stories. You know, someone who has survived and thrived for 20 years. It's just fantastic to hear. There was something that you said just before, which was 20 years ago, you thought Black women don't get breast cancer. I wanted to ask, why do you think that you didn't think that you could get breast cancer?
I think it was because when you saw all of the images, when they talked about breast cancer, it was always somebody who looked like she was from the home counties or the Women's Institute. So not even from colour, but it almost seemed like a very middle class type of disease. Mm. And that's because all the other women who were getting it were just not visible. So, of course, I never saw anybody who looked like me who had cancer. And, of course, within the community, even those who did have it kept it very quiet, even from close family. And it was only after I'd been diagnosed and gone through my treatment, and then I started talking to other family members, that I then realized that, in fact, there had been incidents of breast cancer in our extended family, but it was just never discussed.
I'm really interested to ask how much you think that has changed in the last 20 years. Do you see more visibility now for people of colour in terms of cancer diagnosis and treatment?
Oh, absolutely. It's changed and improved so much more. And I think, obviously, the work of breast cancer now, but certainly I think we've moved beyond that image that breast cancer is the something that somehow blights the white middle classes, and actually it's a scourge for all of us, and anybody can be impacted. And if you look at the, you know, the fact that so many people are being diagnosed, it's you would almost say that it's an epidemic. Mm-hmm. And actually what's changed is that more people like me are living and moving beyond breast cancer, whereas previously you get it and then you would die. Yeah. And that would probably because of late diagnosis. But what's changed is that people are being diagnosed a lot earlier. And also I think because people are seeing it on the internet, you have various advocates. There are a lot of younger women who are getting breast cancer and being very vocal about their experience and really encouraging people to check their breasts, to be an advocate for their own well-being, to be pushing in demand to see their doctor and to request a referral, which is their right. Mm-hmm. And just making sure that people are empowered and removing that stigma. You know, breast cancer isn't something, it's not karma. It's not payback for something you did in a previous life. It's not something that you've eaten. It's not a sign of demonic possession, or that you're somehow not worthy in the eyes of the Almighty. You know, it could be down to just genes. It could be, you know, because of your lifestyle. It could be, you know, as I said, genes or family history. You know, there's so many things. But what I try and do is to say to people, it's not something to be ashamed of. You know, anybody can get breast cancer, even men. And it's no respecter of age or color. Or your sexuality. And the thing is, once you think you have it, get it diagnosed. what you need is peace of mind. Is it cancer? Is it not cancer? And if it is cancer, what kind of cancer do you have? And what are the best treatments for that kind of cancer? And if you don't know, then come to Breast Cancer Now, or, you know, there are so many wonderful cancer charities out there who can help give you the facts and insights and support to help you get through it and move beyond it.
And in the first instance, if you're in the UK, go to your GP, because as Absolutely. We both know, you can have incredible experiences on the NHS and with your GP. And it's just a case of reporting whatever symptoms you've got. And thank you also for saying that it's nobody's fault that we get cancer, because I think that a lot of listeners, including me, have experienced that thing of, you know, was it something that I did? Is this karma? Or is it something that I've eaten? Or is it the fact that I've drunk alcohol, or I've smoked, or I've partied, you know, in my 20s or something? So, yeah, that's a really great message to have shared with us. Now, I know you have some stories about your experience with cancer in the workplace. Could you start by telling us where you were working at the time and how your employer reacted, and how, in fact, you broke the news, if you did break the news to them?
Well, I was in a very interesting position. I can laugh about it now, but I was working for a large bank. Just before my diagnosis, I had resigned from the bank to stay on with the regulator as a contractor. When I told the regulator, I think there was shock, but I was fortunate that the person that I reported to, she was very supportive, and the work that I had done for them, she understood the financial impact on me. But I did feel not obligated, but you know, I felt that I owed them a duty of care to return and get on doing the work. And they did make all of the reasonable accommodations to make me feel comfortable. We didn't really do so much remote working back then, but I was allowed to work, do all my research from home, and only come into the office 2 days a week. So even during my chemo, I was still working. And it did slow me down mentally. You know, my brain, which I almost took for granted, which would fire, suddenly it was taking I noticed it. But I think deep down, I thought, to do the job that I'm doing, the skill sets that I was being paid for, I thought, can I continue to work at that level? And so even though I got through it, I realized that I was not going to be the same, and I would need to reevaluate my lifestyle and also the type of work that I was doing, and move away from that high pressure, high performance, full on, where you're working all hours and you're out and about. I was fortunate that I was working in a very supportive environment, but then I talked to other people who had terrible problems. They were being made redundant, even though their employer knew that they might be unwell. And I wouldn't say it's something peculiar to financial services, but I would say in the private sector, there's almost this unwritten rule. Yes, you get paid a lot of money, but you only get it as long as you're fit and healthy. And the minute there's any sign of weakness, then both parties know that's the end of it, and that there's usually a parting of the ways. And then what you try and do is negotiate a nice settlement, which I was able to do. So financially, yes, I had to make some sacrifices and change my lifestyle, but the impact on me was much less than it would have been for other people, some of whom were literally on the poverty line and having to sign on. I never got to that stage, but it did feel uncomfortable at times. And had I not been working, it would have been tricky.
Did you experience at work any, insensitive or discriminatory comments when you were going through your treatment or in terms of your diagnosis?
There would be, I think there were people who didn't realize that I had it. So it was kept reasonably confidential. I was able to get a wig. So most people didn't realize that I was even sick. I never lost any weight. Even when I was going through the chemo, they talk about the chemo glow. So people kept saying to me, have you been on holiday? And, you know, you're having to make excuses. So people would make comments. I guess there's the stereotype that people think what cancer is, that you're like a walking skeleton and that you can tell. But actually, people respond differently. And you can see people who look very healthy. And then a few weeks later, they're gone. And you think, they had cancer. You said, really? Where did that come from? So people would make comments insensitively, not realizing that I had cancer and I was going through treatment. And I wouldn't say anything to not, you know, because it wasn't said in malice. And I thought maybe I would have said or made those assumptions before I was stricken myself. So I would almost say I was a silent observer watching people making some of the comments that probably I made when I was ignorant and didn't know any better. And I remember thinking, once I finish, I need to retire early so I can actually give something back. Because in my darkest days, when I really thought the prognosis looks really bleak, I spoke to a wonderful woman who just provided a sounding board and just explained to me, listen, there are women who've had similar diagnosis to you and they've got through it. And she was very matter of fact, a lovely Geordie lady. And she just gave me the kick up the bum that I needed to stop wallowing self-pity. And as bad as you think you've got it, there are others who are suffering far worse. She said, you've got money in the bank. She said, you don't have to worry about paying your mortgage. You have your family around you and your employer is supporting you. And you seem to have really good treatment on the NHS. And I thought, actually, and yes, I am a black woman, but I think because I was in London, I had the right support network, I was able to take advantage and benefit from the best of the NHS.
It seems you were fortunate on many counts. Is that early retirement that you took, is that what led you to become a trustee for Breast Cancer Now?
Yes. It was, I'd made the decision that if I got to 55, then I would quit and take advantage of my early retirement benefits. And I applied to Breast Cancer Care, thinking that I'd be a volunteer and actually talk to women who look like me and other women, particularly those, you know, who may be in the socio demographics where they don't have access to all the amenities, and to give that voice of hope and inspiration and share my experiences. And when I spoke to Breast Cancer Care, because my background in policy, risk and governance, they said, well, actually, could you join as a trustee? And I remember thinking, oh, am I jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, having just, resigned from financial services? But I've loved it and I continue to enjoy it. And being part of the board, being engaged in the strategy and the direction. And one of the things we talked about at Breast Cancer Care, and I said, it's wonderful that we focus on helping women and men to think of life after cancer and about living, but living well. I said, but wouldn't it be great if we could also tackle the research and find a cure or some form of early diagnosis that can give people that reassurance and make sure people are getting the right treatment that's tailored for them, rather than the sort of sheep dip approach that I went through. And so, you know, within 2 years, we were having, you know, the merger discussions with Now, and we are Now Breast Cancer Now. And we're having a real positive impact and influence on how breast cancer is being tackled here in the UK.
I know you you do some work separately for diversity on boards around the UK. Do you also do diversity work within Breast Cancer Now, or do you help support the strategy in terms of, you know, making breast cancer more visible for people of colour?
Yes. So, of course, after the George Floyd incident, where I think there was this light bulb moment for most of the world. For somebody like me, I'd always been aware that actually what the George Floyd incident meant was actually it brought our white allies felt that they could stand up and make their voices heard as well. And it's been wonderful to see that shift in understanding and a recognition of inequalities. And when we talk about inequalities, it's interesting when I think about my own experience with cancer and also what we saw more recently with COVID and people sort of when COVID hit looking and thinking, why are so many Black and Brown NHS people getting hit by COVID? But of course, you know, COVID isn't racist and neither is breast cancer. These are things of opportunity, and the more opportunities they get to access you, the greater your chances of actually either getting COVID or indeed being impacted by cancer. And so, of course, things like lifestyle, accessing a GP, assuming that there is a GP practice within your immediate locality. The type of work that you do, if you're gig economy or a shift worker, again, that will all limit your ability to get that GP appointment. The experience I had with my GP, I don't think those, with the way the NHS has gone now and the increasing demand on its services, you know, it does worry me that, you know, people may have breast cancer, but it's not being diagnosed because they cannot get into to see their GP because you have to be referred.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, one of the things that I was never aware of as a white-skinned patient is that people of colour also experience difficulties in terms of access to wigs that are suitable for them, lymphedema sleeves, all sorts of things that, you know, I just would never have realised was lacking for people of colour. Is that something that you experienced as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I remembered laughing when I had my chemo and they showed me the wigs they had available. And the woman looked at me and we looked at the wigs. There were sort of different shades of blonde, ash blonde. I think there's a red one. And one that was sort of jet black, which would have been fine had I been sort of Asian, but not really suitable for me. But again, I'd already realised that. And so my hairdresser actually did a tailored custom wig for me, which matched my hairstyle. And she cut my hair, had a pixie cut. And so we did the wig in the same cut, and then we shaved all my hair off. So most people didn't even realize that I'd lost my hair because I had a tailored wig. And then with the lymphedema, I was able to get private lymphatic drainage, which I had on paid for privately through my private medical insurance. So I never had the dreaded lymphedema and I didn't have to wear the sleeves. But again, not everybody has access to that. And yeah, and you see that in so many walks of life where you can't get things that are tailored to match the color of your skin. And nobody wants to walk around advertising the fact that, oh, look at me, I have cancer. But then again, you see some of the younger girls and they're getting wonderful tattoos done on their head, and they're happy to be proud and show their shaved heads. And that's wonderful.
If there's anyone, any people of colour listening to this podcast today who are struggling with access to wigs or to lymphedema sleeves, which we should explain, lymphedema is a very painful arm condition that some people experience after breast cancer surgery.
Yes.
Is there any direction you could point those women in to help find the services that they need?
Yep. Come to Breast Cancer Now. We have a wealth of information, and we also have our app Becca as well, which can provide some useful hints and tips. And in fact, there's probably more information available now than there would have been back in 2004-05. You know, the internet is awash. YouTube. I've seen some wonderful adverts where people are making their own lymphedema sleeves and just ordering material from a very large online retailer who I won't name. But there's so many, in fact, there's so much that you can get. And there's some wonderful groups which you can join, which are focused very much on different groups, whether that's LGBTQ+, or whether that's by your ethnicity or by your religion. Because it's not just Black women, but also South Asian women, whether you're Hindu, Muslim, or Buddhist. There are all kinds of different support networks out there, and you can find some that are UK-wide or specific to your town or city. But certainly there's a lot of information on the Breast Cancer Now website where we can signpost people to where they can get support. And that support is free. You know, you don't need to pay for it. And also, as part of your diagnosis and treatment, if you are going through treatment, the breast cancer care nurses have a wealth of information and are very supportive. But of course, you need to get referred in the first place. So for me, the real challenge is around early diagnosis. Because if you don't know that you're sick, you know, every day that ticks by, that malignant growth is sitting inside you, it's like a ticking time bomb. The quicker they can get to it, the better the outcome. And even if they don't get to it soon, well, hopefully I'm an example that there is still hope. And even if it gets into your lymph nodes, if it's treated, and if you respond well, and the treatments that we have now, every year there's something new coming out. And of course, with the growth of AI, where we're seeing breast cancer treatment, which is tailored to your physiology, which is fantastic, then again, that's just increasing your chances of a successful outcome.
Yeah, well, we'll put a bunch of those links that you mentioned in the show notes of this episode for anyone who wants to look for resources and advice. I'd just like to ask you about AI, artificial intelligence, because I don't know much about what's being done with AI in breast cancer treatments, and don't know if it's relevant in diagnosis as well. Is that something you can tell us more about?
Well, I think the one area where AI is being tested is obviously radiography and doing the scans, because obviously when you have your scan, then you're reliant on a skilled radiographer to review that scan and being able to look at the scans and say, is that cancer? And now you've got AI systems that can just race through ultra fast and are getting to a percentage which is approaching that of a skilled radiographer. So the challenge you have in all cancer diagnosis, not just breast cancer, is that early diagnosis. And of course, it takes many years to train a radiographer. And a lot of the great radiographers that we had are either retired or reaching retirement, and we just can't replace all of them. So AI, this is an area where AI can be a real benefit, because it can go through more scans more quickly, and the quicker it can do that, and with great accuracy, the better you as a patient can then get that reassurance. So rather than waiting maybe a week or 2 weeks or maybe longer, you might get confirmation within 48 hours.
Brilliant.
Which is fantastic.
And it sounds like something that could ease the strain on the NHS as well. Although, yes, of course, we still do need all of those oncologists and nurses and radiographers,
absolutely,
to, you know, deliver the results and to talk to the patients. And, you know, I very much hope AI never replaces our doctors and nurses entirely. But it's great that it's becoming a support in some ways to the services that we need. Just moving back to breast cancer and diagnosis in the workplace. You were fortunate that you had a good experience in the workplace when you were diagnosed with breast cancer. Obviously, lots of people don't have such a great experience. Is there anything you would say to, first of all, to employees who have a cancer diagnosis and want to approach their workplace about, you know, what things that they might need?
I think I would say it's about prepare yourself and be ready to be your own advocate. Although my experience with my employer wasn't as bad, that was more through my own efforts rather than my employer. And I would say to any employee, try not to, and it's not always easy, but you never want to be wholly reliant on your employer. It's your health, it's your life. You are the best person to manage that. And so it's about making sure you have the right resources around you. And some of those will be the employer. So look at the benefits package. What support do you get? Is there a well-being health check? A lot of organizations offer it. It might be free. So make use of it. And also, you know, find out from other employees, you know, whether it's a new job that you're going for. A lot of people just look at the salary. But I always say, look at the overall benefits package. You know, it's not just about what they're paying you, but actually, if you get sick, how many weeks sick leave do you get full pay on? And you'd be amazed. Some employers are very generous, others less so. So it's about being informed and looking beyond just the numbers. And also looking at, you know, if people do get cancer, have a look at the board members, have a look at their website, read their annual report. You know, what do they say about supporting cancer charities, or, you know, do they have employee well-being? What provisions do they make if you get sick? You know, can you work from home? Can you get additional support? And when will that support be provided? And again, I think good employers are becoming, you know, very focused on well-being, and some employers do it very, very well. They may not always advertise it, and some of this stuff is there. And I talk to staff and say, well, you do realize your firm offers this? And they say, do they? And they haven't looked. And you go and say, well, it's there on the employee benefits website. You have to take advantage of it.
You mentioned at the beginning when you were talking about your diagnosis, you were working 60 to 70 hour weeks in financial services, very high stress, very long hours type of industry. I had a fairly similar experience where in my 20s, throughout my 20s, I was also working in a sort of financial services role, similar, working incredibly long hours, incredibly high stress. And my cancer diagnosis came at the end of that 6-year period of stress where I just moved to a new job. But I remember in the years leading up to my cancer diagnosis, which was when I was 29, I had had other kind of stress-related illnesses like shingles and acne and just, you know, things that were much more minor, but where I would go to the GP and they would say, are you in a high, you know, the job that you have, is it very, very demanding and intense? And can you take some time off? And they would always say things like, can you improve your work-life balance? And can you take some time off? And of course, when you're in one of those jobs, or, you know, you're in a similarly demanding situation where perhaps you've got young children and you're also working two jobs and you're working shifts or you're self-employed, it's always incredibly difficult to take that time off that the GP recommends, because you can't financially, you can't, lifestyle wise, you just can't. So is there anything that you would recommend to someone who is perhaps in a similar position and hasn't got a breast cancer diagnosis, but is feeling like if they carry on at the pace that they're at, then they will be, you know, diagnosed with some kind of serious illness at some point down the line?
You know, that's a great question. And one of the things I say when I'm talking to potential board candidates, I always say to them, no one ever got to retirement wishing, oh, if only I'd worked harder. And it usually gets a laugh. But the point I'm making is the things that are really important is your health, friends and family and well-being. And so when we talk about making adjustments to our lifestyle, and I use my own example, I was working so many hours. I was on a good salary, but I didn't even have time to go shopping. So I had a very healthy bank balance, but actually, could I have managed on half of that money? Probably. Mm. And I understand it's a bit like being on that treadmill, and it's very difficult to step off. So actually working full pelt can mask a lot of underlying issues. And I would always say to people, you cannot function well, if you don't have your health, if you're not at your maximum stage of well-being. And so it's about giving yourself a chance, and it's about looking at your lifestyle and saying, okay, do I need to work harder, or actually do I need to work smarter? And if your employer can't support you in that, and find another employer. You know, if you're skilled, if you have a special talent, you know, one employer may not treat you or may not give you the flexibility, but a competitor might, and you may have to take maybe a 5% cut, or you may even get a pay rise, and it's a win-win. And although it's sad that it took COVID to lift the scales, we do at least now have a recognition around hybrid working. Mm. And I think that gives people more opportunities to pace themselves. You know, you don't need to be running full pelt 24 hours a day. The majority of companies and leaders that I speak to, a common thread across all of that is they refer to their staff, their people, their employees, whatever term they use, as their most valued asset. And I said, well, that's interesting, because if you value that asset so much, why would you treat it in this manner? You know, if you have something that you love and which is precious, then you protect it. And that means not just saying the words, but actually providing that infrastructure. So things like well-being, you know, how do you respect that? Treat your staff well, because by and large, you will see that paid back in terms of productivity. But when you look at an organization where there's incidences of sick leave, or they're being taken to tribunals, or there's lots of complaints, these are all the warning signs that notwithstanding we value our staff, that you have a problem and you can't ignore it. Mm. And the solutions are quite simple and don't necessarily require money.
And it's about having people like you in those companies who are actually standing up and saying these things, because everything that you've just said really resonates with me. I've heard time and time again companies talking about well-being just as a buzzword, but they don't necessarily mean it, and they don't show that they value those employees as much as they say that they're going to value them. So, yeah, I mean, actually respecting people's holidays, actually respecting people's weekends, respecting people's downtime, people's lunch hour. You know, not many people even take a proper lunch hour because we're just so on. So I would say I recommend sitting down, turning your phone off, reading a book, reading some pamphlets. You know, Breast Cancer Now has so many wonderful resources that are on paper that you don't have to read online, even though there's everything you could possibly want online as well. And you have to be on your some kind of device to be listening to this podcast. So I know I know how hard it is myself to switch off. But you've raised some absolutely wonderful points. So thank you for that. I would like to ask you the question that we ask all our guests on the Breast Cancer Now podcast, which is, if you could see one change in diagnosis and treatment of breast cancer in the coming years, what would it be?
Oh, we've seen so many advances. And you obviously want that to continue. I think AI, it can be a wonderful tool. It's not a replacement for a doctor, but it can be a great tool for early diagnosis. I think the holy grail is a simple blood test that can detect a cancer in a meaningful way, and then aligning that to a tailored treatment which is suitable for you and you alone. Mm. And that treatment is designed to maximize the best outcomes for you. And I think if we can get to that, then I would say we've probably achieved as a charity what we set out to achieve, you know, which is for everyone, you know, to be diagnosed early. And when they are diagnosed, to live and live well.
Yeah, that would be absolutely fantastic. And it's something that we're seeing across different areas as well. I know that there are also ways that you can tailor your diet now according to your own particular physiology and everything else. So really exciting and interesting things coming out with AI and with personalized kind of health services. Sonia, is there anything else that you would like to share with us today with regards to your own breast cancer experience, your work with diversity, your work on boards, and your work with cancer in the workplace?
Try not to despair. You know, there is always hope. There are some wonderful people out there who can help you, who can listen. And, you know, this is not you. You know, this is something that affects all of us. And you may not have cancer yourself. You may be supporting someone who has cancer. You know, the early stage when I was diagnosed, I think there's something almost quite selfish. It's your cancer. But I didn't realize at the time the impact that it had on my siblings and on my friends who didn't know what was happening. They felt they couldn't help. I was very self-sufficient and kind of kept it to myself. And actually what it made me do was it made me more open and not be afraid to ask for help, not be too proud. Now, I always was very proud of my the fact that I was self-sufficient and very self-reliant. But actually this was a time when I could ask for help. and people wanted me to ask because they were desperate to give me the help. So it did make me more respectful, more grateful, and able to show that gratitude. You know, the best way to get through it is to get through it with friends and family. And if you've got that network, it really does help. You know, don't do it on your own.
Yeah, I think that's the best advice, Sonia. And it's so wonderful to see you here thriving 20 years on. So, Sonia, thank
touch
you
wood.
So much. Yes, touch wood. Thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. Thank you.